Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Episode 40 has a geological flavour. We look at some of the proposed sites on the Moon that could be investigated by the unmanned CLIPS, or the manned Artemis landings. CLIPS, CLPS, is NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services mission, under which companies are paid to deliver experiments to the Moon. In this program, you will hear advocations for going to special features on the Moon. They are fascinating because they are different from the boring rest of the Moon. But hang on a mo. How do you know how special they are until you have studied the boring parts first? Timothy Livengood of Greenbelt's Goddard Space Flight Center was one of a bunch of scientists who met in November of 2021 and debated where to send landing investigations. Timothy put the case for visiting a geologically neutral site.
All right, so I am going to argue for why we should go to some place that is actually pretty much as dull as possible. And the goal will be to look at the global phenomena that happen every place on the Moon, including space weathering, hydration, and the diurnal variation in hydration on the surface, or at least what appears to be diurnal hydration, and the surface gardening. And there's some context for that in the scientific context for exploration of the Moon, with two of the concepts that are addressed in there are things that could be directly addressed by this. And in particular, I want to point out a surface phenomenon, the halo around Neil Armstrong's head in the shadow here due to the very low phase angle measurement there, essentially opposition effect. And one of the things we want to understand is the actual physical structure of the surface that leads to opposition effect events like that. A problem with going to unique locations is that they're unique. They have a unique history on which is overlaid the global phenomena that happen everywhere on the Moon. But in order to distinguish the two, you'll need a substantial supply of unique locations that you have visited before you can really fully dissect the separation between what happened uniquely locally and what is global on the Moon. Whereas if you go to a place where essentially nothing's going on other than the global phenomena, you can make that straightforward. They also have, of course, unique geochemistry in unique locations when we look at the volcanic provinces. And these properties lead to unique instrumentation also. It's designed to exploit that particular location and often may not be ideal for measuring the things that happen globally, or they may not even be capable of it. And of course, I think of the way we got through decades and decades, okay, multiple decades of studying the Moon without noticing that there's a hydration cycle because we carefully avoided looking at water because we knew it wasn't there. And then finally, there are incentives against having global capabilities in a focused mission because you are always having to deal with the question of how do you deal with finite resources, very restricted resources, that if you're looking at a phenomenon that could be measured anywhere in the Moon, then why would I be spending my unique resources measuring it here, or my limited resources measuring it here? So I want to go to a place where we can do exactly that, measure these interesting global phenomena. And so we can select a site that's dominated by the global properties that are happening, the things that are happening everywhere on the moon. It provides us a control site that we can use to understand those global phenomena and then use that for comparison to all of these other interesting locations that we're hearing about today. It represents the majority of the lunar surface. If you look at a map, you know, we can see that the majority of the lunar surface can be represented as kind of essentially bland. And then it, of course, it has unique locations buried within it. One of the things, though, that we would also want to look at is the representative undisturbed surface of the moon. So at any location, you can look for having the value of mobility to get outside the blast radius of your rocket motor. But we want to understand what are the things when you do that that are representative of the entire moon. Since we have relatively coarse information on mineralogy everywhere on the moon, high resolution sensing at even a nominally bland site is important to understand, again, what kind of distributions we have locally. And then finally, we want to look at microscale phenomena that are invoked throughout the solar system, all over the moon, but on asteroids and other bodies too, to understand the photometry of those sites. And hydration, I'll just say the word. And to do that, you need a representative site, you need to be able to map mineralogy, you need a microscope, and that means you need mobility to get outside the region that you've just damaged with a rocket motor, preferably on the near side, because that makes downlink simple, and preferably with a capability to examine the subsurface too. But that is, again, not quite as critical.
Now, let's hear the pleas for special features. The Earth has major tectonic features where plates of crust grind past each other, crash into each other, or separate. The Moon has none of these planet-wide features. But, according to Caleb Fassett of the Marshall Space Flight Center, nanotectonic landforms do exist on the Moon and are worthy of investigation.
When I saw the call for this particular landing site workshop, my mind instantly went to think about basin rocks. But I realized that the report that Erica Jowen talked about earlier did a nice job describing the science case for looking at the age of basins on the moon. And so I looked at what landing sites were captured in that document, and I tried to pick out something I thought was sort of not fully captured yet. And one of the things that I'm scientifically very interested in are some of the landforms that Dorsal Aldrovandi is an example of, which are these young, big thrust faults on the moon. But I kind of come about it backwards, which is I really like these landforms partly because they give really good exposures of fresh, large rocks on the surface. So this paper here, the geology paper in the center here by Valentinus and Schultz, showed this really nicely, and also the French et al. Paper. You know, there are lots of rocks in some of these big wrinkle ridges. That's partly how we know they're young. And so we could go and explore them both in terms of the wrinkle ridges themselves, but also the geology of the areas they're cutting. So you all have heard already that the advancing science of the moon called out seismicity and recent tectonism as one of these goals. And so we could address that by visiting one of these locations. That's kind of the low-hanging fruit. And then also looking at the character of the surface and subsurface of these locations by actually transecting across them with mobility, I think is important. Perhaps the thing that I'm bringing to the equation here is that you can also get these landforms as a way of looking at the fresh materials, the materials that are exposed in the last 100 million years or more. The actual cause, the lunar evolution causes of these tectonic features remain kind of unknown. So we don't know whether it's, you know, subsidence due to mare loading or orbital recession or tides or global contraction or almost any mechanism you could come up with geophysically for why these landforms are young. But I think exploring them more would help address that question, and also figuring out whether they're the current source of the young, shallow moonquakes. Dorsal Aldrovandi, it runs basically for a few hundred kilometers on the eastern flank of Serenitatis. So if you started at the top and transected down this landform, you could eventually get down to Torres Litro and actually revisit that site if you had enough mobility. Almost all the places that are anomalies in rock abundance on the moon are young, fresh craters. And these wrinkle ridges are the exception. So they give really amazing exposures of rock fields across a lot of the terrain of eastern Serenitatis here, including parts of the highlands to the northeast as well. And so you could look at highlands and possibly Mare rocks and some of the rocks exposed in young cut craters. And with the cameras and remote sensing instruments, you could, in principle, look at the actual, you know, relationships between grains, the textures of rocks, some of the things that are harder to do when you only have regular exposures. And so, you know, we don't have road cuts on the moon. We don't have, you know, nice river cuts. But we do have these places where there are big rocks brought to the surface recently for us to look at. And so what I think about what measurements you actually need to do with this mission, I basically basically assess the seismicity, figure out whether or not these are the young moonquake sources currently, image the subsurface somehow, use GPR probably or some other technique that allows you to look at the actual fault geometry, and then bring a camera too. And let's look at some of these rocks, maybe do some geochemistry on the surface of the very freshest exposed material on the moon. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Marshall Eubanks thinks he has seen evidence for active tectonics on the moon.
I've become very interested in active lunar tectonics. I mean, for a long, long time, everybody thought the moon was just dead except for things that hit it or poked it. So in other words, except for tidal perturbations, which are tens of centimeters maybe globally, and except for meteorite impacts, you know, nothing happened on the moon. And now we find that that's not really the case. There has excellent, excellent evidence for, in my opinion, for active lunar tectonics. And they seem to be connected to these wrinkle ridges, but also some other areas, and there's lots of them. And by lots, I think the way of thinking about that is, you know, of the five or so surveyors that worked and of the five or so Apollos that worked, 11 total missions, at least two of them landed within walking distance of what looks like an active tectonic area, Apollo 17 and Surveyor 6. These things are not that uncommon. And so that suggests that the CLIPS, probably any CLIPS landing, could almost find one of these nearby to investigate. And that suggests to me, how do we do this on the Earth? Well, there's a variety of ways, but geodesy is a crucial one. And so we've been working on geodetic ways of looking at this. And it was actually looking at the ground motions that have to be associated with any major earthquake. And some of these are major earthquakes. They're bouncing boulders around. It would be very bad for an astronaut who happened to be there at the time. Thank you.
Thomas Walters sees evidence for young lobate thrust fault scarps when he looks at images of the lunar landscape. He also notes evidence for shallow moonquakes, or SMQs as he calls them.
The importance, I think, tectonics has become for the moon, said without beating the drum too hard, it has been largely overlooked. But I think now we are starting to see that tectonics is a really important component of our understanding of the moon. So, yeah, we're going to propose, and I want to acknowledge my co-authors here, are proposing that we land near one of these young thrust faults. So these young thrust faults were really largely unknown. They were only a few found in the highest resolution Apollo era imaging, mostly in the Apollo panoramic camera photographs. Global distribution was really unknown until we got to the moon with LRO and LROC and the NAC, which was capable of observing these small fault scarps. And you can see from the map, they are everywhere on the moon. We now know there are thousands of these very young thrust fault scarps. And we know they're young, not only because they're small scale and their pristine appearance, but also because of their interaction with very, very small diameter impact craters. If these faults are currently active, they're going to produce moonquakes. And fortunately, we had the Apollo seismic network operating for the period shown there and detected 28 shallow moonquakes, some with Richter equivalent magnitudes of up to 5. But we really didn't know what the source of these shallow moonquakes were. But now, based on a reanalysis and the locations of the epicenters of those shallow moonquakes, we now believe that some of these young scarps are in fact the source of these shallow moonquakes. All right, and they're probably being formed or could be being formed by new fault scarps being formed or slip events on existing thrust fault. So let's talk about the landing site we're proposing. It's the Korolev cluster, and clusters are collections of these scarps. In this case, this cluster is outside the Korolev basin, It consists of more than 20 individual scarps that extend about 140 kilometers in length. It's a far side location. Sorry, I don't have enough decimal points there. That location, what we'd like to do is set down near the foot wall of one of these thrust fault scarps, and we've picked one here as an example. And one of the reasons why is it has access to a boulder field that Caleb was talking about that exists on the wrinkle ridges. And they also occur on some of these lobate thrust fault scarps. From the slope map, you can see that there are areas, there are multiple areas, again, where the slopes are low enough that a rover would have a reasonably good chance of traversing one of these. The other really importance about this site is it's near the tidal axis of the moon. And this, from our current stress models, is where the compressional stresses peak. So this is kind of where we would expect enhanced activity on these very young faults. So what are the science objectives? Well, we really want to determine if these young thrust faults or even the wrinkle ridges, these reactivated ancient wrinkle ridges, are potentially sources for the shallow moonquakes. We'd like to determine the frequency and magnitude of shallow moonquakes on the far side. We'd like to do a direct characterization of one of these fault scarps and examine directly any secondary structures we find. We want to explore the subsurface to determine the nature and specifically the geometry of the underlying fault. We'd like to determine the effects of slip events on these faults by looking at exposed fresh and or redistributed boulders and regolith. And we'd like to characterize, again, just help to characterize the seismicity of the far side. Also, with the idea of assessing the seismic hazards that these thousands, again, of young thrust fault scarps may represent. So capabilities are, we need a lander that is capable of deploying and supporting a rover. And of course, it'll have to have the power and communications support, as well as be able to support an instrument package. Enhanced capabilities is really the ability to survive the lunar night, because we're going to want to be around long enough with, as these instrument packages detail, with seismometers, both long and short period, to be able to detect a shallow moonquake or multiple shallow moonquakes. And we're going to want imaging systems, of course, wide and narrow angle cameras. The rover is going to have to be capable of traversing slopes up to 10 to 15 degrees. And we would need to be able to travel distances of at least 3 to 5 kilometers. And again, enhanced capability would be for that rover to be able to return to the lander and somehow could be configured so it could survive multiple lunar nights. And the instrument on the rover, the principal one, would be a multi-frequency ground-penetrating radar and, of course, imaging system.
Most of the craters on the moon are formed by asteroids striking the surface. Most of these happened billions of years ago, but even today, new craters are formed. Emerson Spayura wants to explore a newly formed impact crater.
You know, studying impact craters has been something we've been doing for quite a while. We've had a select few go and explore impact craters on the moon. We've also had thousands of geology students go and study craters like Meteor Crater here in Arizona. And then the U.S. government has also created some craters that we've been able to study, like the Sedan Crater. In addition to that, we've done modeling. Some of that has been numerical modeling. Another example is where we actually look at how impact craters form by doing impact experiments. So with LRO, we've been able to discover a whole abundance of newly formed impact craters that have formed in the last decade. And an example is 70-meter crater over to the right. And with the LROC cameras, we've been able to reveal different reflectance zones around the crater, up to 4 that typically form. With Diviner, looking at these new impact sites, they've been able to identify new cold spot features. With LAMP, they've been able to see distinctive reflectance responses. And with MINIRF, they've been seeing increased scattering around these craters. We're learning a whole bunch just from these newly formed impact craters, but now it's time to actually go and explore one of these features close up. The science objective for a CLIPS mission would basically be to go and examine the stratigraphy of the impact site. So really understanding what the stratigraphy is, because that's important to understand how the crater forms in different areas on the moon under different material properties and under different conditions. Next is to resolve the physical properties and composition of the proximal and distal reflectance zones that we see with LROC. So basically determining and understanding how these craters are formed. So we have some good examples of some simple craters here. And then also determine the nature of splotches. So we see these distal secondary impacts around the site. And so really understanding what those are. Are there actually small craters there? Are these first secondaries? What's really going on? And as a bonus, we can also look at one of the Lunar Exploration Roadmap Feed Forward objectives, which was to learn how to operate in different geologic settings on the moon. And studying an impact crater like this, the idea is that you start far from the impact site and you work your way toward it. And as you progress closer and closer to the impact site, it's going to get a little bit harder to traverse because there's going to be some rocks and things like that to go around. One benefit of looking at new impact craters is there's over 500 so far to choose from. I selected four here that I think would be good candidate sites. One is a 70 meter crater I showed on the previous slide. We also have a 35 meter crater. There's also two impact flashes that we observed, one on September 11th and one on March 17th. And the benefit of those is we do have a great photometric library of observations taken after that those impacts occurred, and we understand those sites pretty well. But you basically start off landing near some splotches and then work your way toward the crater and go in and out of the reflectance zones. So the required capabilities, precise landing near some of these splotches. You do need some sort of rover capability to actually move several kilometers. This would be to visit several splotches as well as traverse across different zones. And then camera capabilities, need a couple different wavelengths and a robotic arm to provide some perspective. But so this gives us a chance to explore a new crater that was just formed basically yesterday. So and provide insight into how the impact process really works. Yeah. Thank you.
Saichi Nagihara of Texas Tech University is advocating a CLIPS mission to Mare Imbrium. Here's why.
So yeah, I'm going to try to make a case to send the CLIPS mission to Mare Imbrium. So the science objective is to determine whether or not radionuclides in the PKT are fully partitioned in the crust or not. So during the early evolution of the moon, so somehow all the radionuclides, heat-producing elements, ended up pooling in the region of the near side, which now we call PKT, right? But we still don't know if all these incompatible elements were efficiently fully partitioned into the crust, or we still have quite a bit left in the mantle. So that will kind of, you know, changes our understanding of the evolution scenario of the moon, right? So that's what we want to investigate. So that objective can trace back to the original the SKIM report in 2007, and also that was reaffirmed by the LEAK study a couple of years ago, you know, to characterize the thermal state of the interior and illustrate the workings of the planetary heat engine. So the rationale for going to Mare Imbrium. So the one way to check or test whether there are some heat-producing elements left in the mantle under the PKT crust or not is to actually try to measure the heat flow that comes out of the mantle of the PKT, right? But we have no way of actually measuring the mantle heat flow directly, but we can measure the heat flow out of the surface of the moon. If you measure the heat flow on the surface of the moon, so we are also measuring the heat produced within the crust as well, right? So that's why one way to go at the mantle heat flow is to go to a place where we think the crust doesn't produce much heat. Then in PKT, then there's one place you can do that. So that's Mare Imbrium. So the Mare Imbrium, as you can see from this thorium map from Kaguya mission, so has a big low blue spot there of the thorium concentration. This is because the basin forming impact has actually excavated much of these heat producing element rich crust, right? So also because of that, the crust there is thin. So that's why we expect that the Mare Imbrium is a unique window where you can actually go there and measure the heat flow at the surface. Then that should be more or less close to the heat flow that comes out of the mantle, right? Let's say we can measure the mantle estimate the mantle heat for Imbrium, out of the Imbrium, but we still need to know if it's any higher or, you know, hotter than, or the colder than the areas outside of PKT, right? Then fortunately, so we are already going to Mare Crisium on the CLIPS mission in 2023. So that's the land that has been already selected from Firefly. We can compare that results between the Crisium and the Imbrium. Then, so that will allow us to see if the Imbrium mantle heat flow is any higher. So that will also add more value to the Crisium mission as well. So we have these instruments that measured heat flow and also magnetospheric measurements. Then by combining two measurements, then we can actually get a temperature and electrical conductivity and the compositional profile down to the upper portion of the mantle. So that's why we just need a static lander. Then we just have to be careful about selecting a landing site to avoid any major rocks and so forth. And then again, the payload mass and the power, you know, requirement is small. So that's why you have plenty of room for other payload as well. Okay, thank you.
NASA's Dan Moriarty has his heart set on Mons Maliport in the South Polar region.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. In this talk, I'll be briefly presenting the case for establishing lunar surface assets at Mons Maliport. So our region of interest is an elevated ridge on the lunar near side in the South Polar region. Due to its elevation and location, Maliport receives higher than average solar illumination over the course of the lunar day, while maintaining uninterrupted line of sight to Earth. Maliport presents a unique confluence of opportunities for conducting high priority science and establishing enabling architecture for Artemis and other South Polar missions. So the uninterrupted Earth visibility makes Maliport an excellent candidate location for laser ranging from Earth, as well as radio tracking. And these can really help us establish better geophysical analyses of the moon. The high latitude location results in a longer path length through the lunar exosphere and ionosphere when we're looking towards Earth. And so therefore, Maliport is an ideal location for monitoring transient changes in those related to Artemis landings and other surface operations. Maliport could also serve as an excellent platform for conducting permanent observations of Earth over long timescales. Apart from science, Maliport could serve as an important communications relay and could offer a redundant backup for orbital solutions being considered for Artemis and other South Polar surface assets. So since a lot of the South Polar region only has about 50% Earth visibility over the moon, the lunar orbital cycle, communications relays will be an important factor enabling sustained exploration of the lunar South Pole. So at Maliport, we'd recommend a stationary lander with a relay antenna on a 5-meter mast. And the lander should be able to operate through the lunar night and should be equipped with retroreflectors for laser ranging and exospheric transmission measurements. The areas with maximum solar illumination do not overlap with the areas of uninterrupted Earth visibility. So if the lander will be powered by solar panels, it would make sense for the panels to be set up in the areas of maximum illumination. These would require some surface mobility and power transmission across distance scales around 100 meters.
As Max Robinson will explain, INA, spelled I-N-A, is a curious feature. Scientists debate energetically about its age. Is it young or not?
My thoughts were to do this within a budget of Eclipse mission and get a definitive answer on the question, young or not. And I loved her statement that the only thing that people can agree on is it's some sort of volcanic landform. I'm going to definitely use that in the future, but I will reference you, Catherine. These two competing hypotheses are important because the conventional wisdom is that lunar volcanism ceased 1 to 2 billion years ago. The Braden et al. Paper looked at small-scale morphology and crater counts. And it's really the small-scale morphology that people, that was pointed out in the Braden paper, that people tend to ignore in previous and subsequent works. But they were incredibly important because in the Braden et al. Work, the authors were very skeptical of the crater counts because it was so young. But it was really the combination of the small scale morphology and the crater counts that led to the publication and the idea that these features are less than 100 million years old. And it was just got an introduction to the alternate hypothesis of magmatic foams by several. I think there's now been 30 or 40 papers that have come out by that group on the topic. My thought was that if we can get very high resolution stereo imaging over key areas that we know where they are right now, but we just don't have the resolution with a NAC. So, but we want to look at small craters, small being, you know, less than 20 meters in diameter, and the edges and the contacts of the two units, the smooth units and the rough floor units. Okay, our overarching science goal is just to differentiate, you know, which one of these hypotheses is right, less than 100 million years old or greater than 3 billion years old. And, you know, this is relevant to many science questions called out in key documents. Okay, our objectives is to determine the physical properties of the two main units, which would be the smooth materials and the uneven materials. We want to delimit and characterize primary volcanic landforms at the 10 centimeter scale, determine the morphology and topology of impact craters down to diameters of 1 meter. An enhancement to this would be, since it's not required, would be investigate the current environment for signs of geologically recent activity, heat flow and gas release. Okay, we would land on that biggest smooth mound on the eastern side. Required capabilities is the CLPS lander needs to land with a plus or minus 100 meter accuracy, and it needs to transmit 50 gigabytes of science data to Earth within 10 Earth days. And then our science is carried out on an aerial platform from which we would want to get stereo images with 1 centimeter per pixel scale over representative landforms and statistically significant area sampling, because once we don't know what we're going to see. So the images, we would also want just monostat or single images with a 0.3 centimeter pixel scale over representative landforms. And then stereo images over a broader area, but at lower pixel scale, 3 centimeters per pixel, because we'd want to get about 3% INA. And then 20 centimeter per pixel images over 10% of INA. And then also when we're taking off, we want to get 10 frame per second, less than 10 centimeter per pixel scale movie of the ascents. Okay, here's our notional CONOPS, how we would collect those images with three different cameras on board an aerial platform, very similar to the Hopper being deployed on the Intuitive Machines 2 mission to the South Pole, and enhance the capabilities. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Even with a large budget, there is no way that all of these suggested and worthwhile sites will be investigated, either by humans or by robots. We shall have to leave the proponents to continue to debate the merits of each and come up with a priority list.